Right, why did I join the Air Force? I made the mistake of only getting two A-levels as a schoolboy and going to university to do a course which was mathematics. And one of the A-levels I didn't get was mathematics. But all my pals were going up to university, and the Queen's University in Belfast was right beside the school that I went to for 15 years. So it was an automatic sort of, didn't even have to change the bus route, for example. Freshers' Day is the day when all the new students arrive, and each club in the university tries to attract you to join them. My girlfriend at that time was in the OTC, Officers Training Corps, which is a university club. And I thought, well, if I join her in uniform, if they'll take me. Got to their stand, the OTC stand, and there was this particularly rude sergeant who was an acquaintance of mine, but he was from the opposite school. Anyhow, I said, explain to me why I should join the OTC. Oh, he said, well, we go on route marches. Really? We drive 15-ton trucks. That might be a bit more interesting. And we go away to camp for 2 weeks a year. Oh, well, that's okay. I said, but don't the Air Force teach you to fly an aeroplane? Yes, he said, but you wouldn't have a chance. Did all their tests, obviously medical, you had the two of everything, to keep it simple. Tube testing, and interviews. 12, I was one of 12. 200 applicants. So that was a good start, wasn't it? But having been told you hadn't a chance, there was wonderful opportunity. And of course, when I started to learn to fly, I could do it. And I enjoyed it. And of course, after 2 years, I gave up with a university degree, went to see the boss and said, look, I'm no longer a student, so I can't really stay on the university air squadron. He said, well, what are you going to do? Well, I haven't decided. He said, you can join the air, you can continue your training in the Air Force and start in a month's time. Honestly, that's the way it was in those days. Things got moving quickly. And I had a word with my parents, who were a little bit upset, but I was 21 at the time, and it was all explained to me. Anyhow, I started the Air Force on the 14th of September, and that's the date you get paid for. I wasn't alone. There were four other guys. We all had started the same engineering course and ended up in the air squadron, and we all went down to South Cerny to do our officer training. And that was the beginning of it. So it was as a result of a bet. I never did meet that guy again. He would have been interested enough to find out. Yeah. Ireland at that time, everybody knew everybody else. So there I was, going through the training system. And of course, some of it was a bit like a flying club, civilian flying club, like flying the Lightning on my first squadron, 23 squadron, up at Lukers. There was a wonderful atmosphere there. We all seemed to fly as a pair, and being air defence, it was one aircraft would be the fighter and the other would be a target, and then you swap over, and you'd be controlled initially by a ground controller, and then you'd use the radar on the aircraft to help you find the target and eventually pretend to shoot it down. And of course you had to take a film of it, but it was only a film. 23 Squadron was wonderful, absolutely outstanding. There were guys from Americans there with on exchange jobs, South African. Honestly, it was wonderful, wonderful experience, until the day one of the guys crashed his aeroplane, got spun in. He was a top-notch pilot, highly qualified, but was in the middle of a combat mission, and he overdid it, and the aircraft flicked and went into the North Sea. But he ejected. He didn't look too well when he came. Yeah, because the cold, the North Sea, we had to obey the rules then in a big way. Well, geez, that Lightning was an expensive aeroplane. Mark 6 Lightning. But we had a mixture of 3s, and 6s, the 6s being the latest, shiny and wonderful. I mean, beautiful aeroplanes, lovely to fly, but useless to go to war in, because there were only two missiles and a gun, which was hopelessly inaccurate. Anyhow, one morning, I used to be able to cycle into work, not because of any other reason than I only had one car and my wife was driving at that time, teaching. Cycling into work, I thought, what the hell is this? All the air squadron aircraft were in a line, 12 of them, all armed to the teeth, and you could see there was something going on. 23 Squadron was in the old control tower at Lugard, climbed up the stairs into the ops room, and the guy who was behind the desk said, you are Q7. I said, what do you mean? He said, we've had a report of 18 Russian aircraft coming round the north coast of Norway, and they're coming down the North Sea, and we're going to intercept them to make sure they know that we know that they're there. Which I thought, wow, this is what it's all about. But eventually I was scrambled, found two Russian bears, intercepted with them. And I don't know if you ever saw some of the photographs that were taken at that time with the bear and then a lightning on top of it. They seem to publish these with the Phantom, then the F-35 and so on, with a bear or some sort of Russian aircraft that had been intercepted over the North Sea. Guess who took that photograph? And that was all because the American, the US Marine Corps guy, said, hey, take this camera. And of course, it was quite a big Hasselblad or something. It was a really expensive camera, but you just kept your finger on it and it worked. He said, any, of course. There was not a lot of room in the Lightning. And so I had to carry this damn thing. But some of the photographs were unbelievable. Yeah. But there I was, fully armed, and of course, all the stories about the crew of the Russian aircraft waving to you, like, we were that close. But I was there looking at this guy's eyes in the back of this aeroplane, do a roll beside them or whatever, and I thought, no, I'm not going to do that.
Did you have set rules of engagement at that particular moment, or were you just a visible deterrent?
But we had rules of engagement. But they would have had to start shooting at us before we'd have done anything.
Yeah.
And they had rules of interception as well. So we probably were quite safe. But having said that, we were right up against them. And if one of us had made a mistake with that bloody camera, you know, wobbling around a bit, maybe trying to take a photograph, it could have been a disaster. So that was the excitement of being part of a real job armed to the teeth, because you started off on the training in the jet provost, the Mark III, which was dangerous because it was so underpowered, the Mark IV, which was much better, but not as nice to fly, then the Gnat, then the Hunter, then the Lightning OCU, and then... you got to the end of a particular course on a Friday, you had to be at the next base on Monday. And of course, you had to use your own car to get there. No, the training couldn't have been better. So the training was the way it should have been. But that was the start of, hey, Craigie, what the hell am I doing here? Fly to Valley for missile practice camp. And this was on the Phantom, which was a little bit later. And the idea was to go press the transmit button, firing now. And then releasing the button. Well, this bloody missile went whoosh right beside me because it was 3 feet away from the cockpit. And the missile going off actually frightened the bloody wits out of me. But that was another occasion when I thought, oh, Christ, I've arrived. Yeah. The next incident was in a Hunter. Had joined 234 Squadron at Brodie.
Okay.
Tactical Weapons Unit. Early 70s, yeah. Arrived on 234 Squadron, qualified, because you've got to do a workup when you arrive. And, okay, you can go to Gibraltar in a week's time. Pardon? Gibraltar? Well, that'd be nice. Oh, but you're going to do a job. You're going to defend the Rock against the Spanish in a Hunter. But, of course, ideally it should have been the Lightning, but the runway there wasn't long enough to operate the Lightning.
Right.
So off we went on an RAF bus, which took us to Gatwick. Flew Britannia Airways in a Britannia to Gibraltar, and there I was sitting on standby in an armed as a teeth hunter. I mean, we're talking about 4-in cannons, 30mm cannons, high explosive ammunition. That was another incident where I thought, you know, nobody mentioned this, but that's what you were trained to do. And what we were there for was to sit when the British Airways aircraft, the scheduled aircraft, came in at night or of an afternoon. So we had to man up with a cockpit in case they were attacked by the Spanish. Hercules would arrive. You know, it was serious stuff. But looking back on that, we were flying off in between Russian ships that were in the harbour and just flying underneath their tails. I'm sure the Navy don't call them tails. Anyway, so we were going flying over the sea and firing these guns and 4-in cannons in front of you. It's just things you never think about that. Mm. The noise was unbelievable. Another incident in Gibraltar, what we used to do, especially if there's only one aircraft serviceable, go and have a look at the Russian boats. There were something like 3 or 4 areas where they would, there's a name for them, anchorages in Tunisia and so on. We used to go and have a look and count them, take photographs of them. One particular incident, I was maybe 100 miles to the east of Gibraltar, call sign, return to Gibraltar immediately. And this was on guard frequency. The whole world must have heard that. I thought, okay, they must want me for something. And what had happened, a small Spanish civil aircraft had made a simulated approach to the runway at Gibraltar, not talking to anybody, overshot, flew down the runway, and then disappeared off towards the Atlantic. And of course, highly dangerous and really ought not to have been seen. But I was armed with a camera, get a number off this guy or whatever he was. And of course, it took me several minutes to get back to Gibraltar and then to find this. It was a little twin engine thing, propeller. And I took pictures of it. Again, finger on the button. But in the Hunter, it was such a stable aircraft, it was lovely. And you know what happened? Obviously, the photographs then went up to command. They then went to the people in Gibraltar, and they were delighted with it. And you know, many years later, I was on an exchange job with the French Air Force, and the general had come down from the embassy to Cazaux, where I was flying from, and he said, "We've had an incident, and the pilots got photographs of this aircraft invading, the airspace around Gibraltar." Yeah. I said, "Well, that was me." And what a wonderful, you know, that was several years afterwards, where he was using, you know, the fact that the Spanish were being a bit naughty. And he said, "We even got a photograph of them."
Did you find out what happened to that plane? Was it, did they locate, you know, who was flying that plane and why?
Oh, God, no.
Did they survive?
You never find out. You're never told of an incident.
You've done your bit and the result goes, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
It would have been nice to find out, though, wouldn't it?
Oh, of course, yeah.
You know, for you.
Yeah, and I'm sure I've got a photograph of that, a copy of it in my logbook somewhere. Anyhow, that was Gibraltar. The next one, which was quite exciting, was flying the Phantom during the Cold War from a base in Germany, Wildenrath, where we were on 5-minute standby, armed to the teeth, and we were brought up from, well, they brought you up to 5 minutes, but you were on 5 minutes anyway, which is cockpit readiness. And of course, lunchtime, you could see the Land Rover, which was threading its way in between the hangars to bring you your lunch. Hot locks, I think they were called. 19 squadron aircraft and a 92 squadron aircraft. This was serious because they never ever scrambled 2 aircraft at the same time. And there I was in the front of that as well. What we were looking for were defectors from the Polish Air Force, but they weren't too sure. But when we actually got to what they were looking at, we just couldn't believe it. It was a single piston, I think it was called a civilian aircraft, camouflaged. It was obviously on some sort of icky-dicky sortie. They weren't talking to anybody, which really they ought to have been. And we, I dusted him, I promise you, for interrupting my lunch.
I was going to say I would have been most upset to get my lunch.
Yeah, oh, craggy. How pathetic, to be honest. But I wanted him to know that I had found him. And he was at something like 7,000 feet coming across the border from East Germany into the West. And of course, there we were in the aircraft that couldn't fly as slow as anything they were. So we just dusted them, passed them back again. But both of us did it.
Were there many defectors during that time?
No, in the end, none came. But we were expecting it, not only in small aircraft, but some of their fighters, which were Russian provided, MiG-21s maybe. But the Americans already found a MiG-21 from somebody from wherever had come over to them, and they'd shipped it back to the US. And you look back at the Polish effort during the Second World War. I mean, the Battle of Britain, probably 15% Polish pilots. Anyhow, there we go. I'm trying to think of the next one. Well, probably my crash, which was fairly interesting. Again, this was 79 Squadron at Brody, Hunter. I was doing a four-ship test, if you like, so that you'd be authorised to lead four aircraft. And off we went. We had two practice, two targets, and another aircraft attacking us to try and prevent us to get to the target. And the singleton was Brian Hoskins, who was the OC Ops. And he found us quite quickly, because it meant my rescue was early afternoon, and I hadn't missed lunch. But that what we were to do was to negate his attack, so that he couldn't get into a firing position on any of us. And that involved turning towards the target once you'd identified him, and ideally to cross like that. And of course, once you'd crossed, you were then to go back onto your original heading to head for the target. And it was on that stage where we negated the threat. Full power, about 450 knots. I mean, going like a train. There was a dull thud from the back of the airplane somewhere. I pulled back on the control column to get a bit of height to try and see what's going wrong. There was another thud. And when I pulled back on the control column, nothing happened. It just continued to descend very slowly. And there was a valley in front of me. And I thought, my turn. In fact, there was no thought process at all. But looking back on it, pulled the ejection seat handle, and the whole thing worked like clockwork. Like the canopy went. Then the Mark II ejection seat had three shotgun cartridges in there. I mean, fascinating, if you ever get a chance to read James Martin's development of the ejection seat. But of course, the bang that got you out of the aircraft at that time was quite severe, and if you were not in a perfect position with your head back, indeed even had time to tighten your straps and so on, you were going to get injured. Could have been 500 miles an hour, but you don't think about it. The aircraft was not responding to your control input, and therefore, get out. And of course, the seat went, the canopy went, the seat, then the drogue. I ended up upside down. I'll just open my eyes now. And there was the fireball underneath me, just orange flames. And I thought, no, do you know what went through my mind? I don't like this. I'll just close my eyes. And it worked. well, when it worked, I didn't panic. What's the point of panicking if you're going to die? But I didn't think that.
Yeah.
That did not cross my mind. So I was upside down, going over the fireball. And the next thing I remember, my feet touching the ground and me falling back into where the fireball had been. So there was smoke everywhere. What I didn't realise that the kit we were wearing was fireproof. I mean, unbelievable. Because normally, you know, you just a flying suit. What's so special about a flying suit? But it saved my life. Or I wasn't badly burnt. And having talked about this in the crew room, what guys said who had ejected before, if you don't have to move quickly, roll away from the danger, rather than stand up and injure your back perhaps even more. And so that's what I did, rolled away from where the fireball had been. And about, we were there, four of us. The number two aircraft was obviously concerned that this aircraft in front of him had just disappeared into the ground. And they didn't see a parachute. Well, I was only in it for a nanosecond before my feet touched the ground. One of the other guys went up medium level to coordinate the... Also, it was a classic recovery. I think number four went back to Brody. But the helicopter arrived. My neighbour came down on the end of a piece of string, dragged me up. You know, there was little...
Sorry if I missed that. What altitude were you when that happened?
I was ground level.
Because, I sort of asked that because when you said you were, it was momentarily, you were in the parachute.
Yes, well, yeah. Mm. And you never think you'd left too late. At least I didn't.
Yeah.
I thought there was plenty of time. But I was going like a train, going gently down towards the ground. One of my experiences as a pilot, I would suggest.
Wow.
I got a tie from Rolls-Royce. Irvine Parachute sent me something as well, probably a box of chocolate. And you become part of the club of ejectees. But if you ever get a chance, read James Martin. There were 6,000 ejections from air forces all over the world. Amazing, absolutely amazing. And he was a local boy from Belfast, a farmer, who nothing was ever put on paper. It was all up here in his head. Why don't we try this? Why don't we do that? And eventually they had the rocket assistance, which was much better. But even the first guy who tried that, very brave man.
During that ejection, you said you injured four vertebrae in your back?
Yeah. The Air Force knew how to treat a problem like that. Once you'd damaged your vertebrae, and it was in Withybush Hospital I ended up in, which was quite scary. And of course, the Air Force doctor came down from Brody and said he must not get out of bed for a month, I think it was. And the nurse in charge said, rubbish, get him out of bed. But in other words, their treatment of damage to the spine was completely different from the Air Force. They said bed rest for a month to allow the bones to harden, because during that ejection, apparently, the bones softened, and if you then got up and walked around, you'd do more damage. So thank you for the Air Force for that. But they casevac'd me to a place in an Air Force hospital in near Swindon. I'll think of the name in a minute. But it's all closed now. These places don't exist anymore.
No.
And so I then spent another 2 months, as it was, I forgot the name of the hospital, but it was for service people. And of course, it was during the beginnings of the Falklands War, and they were shipping guys back who had been on the Canberra, running around with 50-pound packs on their backs and damaging their backs. And of course, I was in a back ward, and these guys were coming back spitting that they were missing the war. I must admit, but the Hunter would not have been used there. It was the Harrier and so on, which saved the Air Force, I think, and many people. So we talked about the Lightning, a little bit about the Phantom in Germany. Those were the interesting bits, were getting airborne in a fully armed aircraft and not really knowing if I was going to have to pull the trigger. And at that time, the Air Force were accepting 600 pilots a year.
How many were making it through training?
A
good percentage.
Yeah, a good percent, because there were so many squadrons.
Mm.
I mean, there were aircraft squadrons by the dozen.
And you were very complimentary about the level of instruction.
Oh, couldn't have been better. Well, I mean, inevitably there were funny bits of that as well. My instructor at Saracen was one of the older guys that had seen Second World War stuff. Taxiing out, it was raining. And there's a drip in front of me. I said, what is this? And he said, lad, it's not a bloody submarine. You know, wonderful little experiences like that.
Yeah.
And of course, you get airborne and didn't drip anymore. But just simple little things like that, wonderful.
Yeah, my question was going to be, your instructors, how many of them had previous like combat experience, I guess?
Well,
particularly the Second World War.
Most of them, to be honest. Yeah. And they didn't want to be where they were.
No.
And that, of course, happened to me eventually as well.
Do you mean on to be an instructor rather than actually sat in an aircraft?
But no, they were brilliant. And Saracen, dear me, what a wonderful base that was. I would do the same thing again. 45 years in uniform, 30 years on the front line, and 15 flying cadets. And that was at Killearn, then St Athan. And I'm sorry to say, it was the girls who were the best. Yep, they were prepared.
To the blokes.
They knew what they were there for.
They were on the ball.
Yeah. And as I say, some of them were outstanding.
That's it.
And wanted to fly the aircraft. Yeah. You say to one of the young guys, would you like to take control? No, I'm quite happy. They said, well, what the hell are you here for?
But so you were an instructor then?
Oh, yeah. You always end up as an instructor of some sort.
Yeah.
And because I'd been on a university air squadron before, the fickle finger of fate said, well, you've done it before as a student, and you know what's expected of you. I ended up in Bristol University Air Squadron. Wonderful 4 years. Then Brodie, then Germany, back to Brodie again, because if you volunteered for Brodie, you got it. The best kept secret in the Air Force.
Right.
You know, you got air wheels undercarriage up and you were already in the low flying area. And that was our job at that time. Then there's quite a good story about the exchange job I did with the French Air Force. Okay, Robinson, why should we send you to France then? I drive a Renault. I have a poodle. Within 2 weeks, I was on a train to get to France. Wonderful. Absolutely wonderful.
How long were you in France, Bob?
Oh, 3.5 years. You were somebody. You know, you're representing the Royal Air Force. And working with the French Air Force. And they were outstanding. Honestly, they would get the job done. And most of them had war experience in Africa, Chad. Apparently they're all pulling back now, the French. But that was on the Alpha Jet, which was like a Hawk, but it had two engines, which was interesting, whereas the Hawk had only one, and having had any experience of a single-engine jet with the engine, the only one you've got, stopping. It's not a good idea. I promise you, the French bit was outstanding. The guy that I was replacing said, you know, Cazaux is near Bordeaux. The weather's always good. I was flying in snow conditions on one day. For example, he said, you don't need to bring any cold weather flying kit. I'd only been on the squadron, the Escadron de Chasse Deux-Huit, we were deployed because there was something happening at Cazaux that they didn't want me to see. It was some sort of exercise, but the range, Cazaux was right beside where they were going to be shooting at the ground and so on. They didn't want me to be there, so they gave me a student, and off we went to Cambrai, which is an air base just north of Paris, in the snow, absolutely freezing. Take off and landing on snow. Now, the Air Force wouldn't let you do that. Why not? We did it in the Alpha Jet. What was I going to say? Oh, yes. Can't we go somewhere a bit warmer to one of the other pilots that had ended up there? He said, leave it to me. And the next day, fly down to Corsica, which... God, when you opened the canopy there, yeah, the smell of the Mediterranean was just wow. The difference between Cambrai in the snow and Corsica in the middle of summer, wow. Or winter would have been, wouldn't it? But what a wonderful experience that was. And we were there for 2 days. Then flew back to Cazaux when the exercise was over. And somebody said, well, they didn't actually want you here at that time. The first year was a struggle with the language. The second year was consolidation. And the third year, I was mistaken for a Belgian pilot. In other words, pigeon French. And, you know, we've had Belgian folk here visiting. And when I tell them that story, they just crease with laughter. Unbelievable.
I can imagine.
It was my job. I didn't find any glory or thinking that I was exceptional. I just was trained to do the job.
Sure.
And did it. And as I said, I would do the whole thing again.
The amount of training must have been extensive for your survival, your navigation, everything.
Yeah, and 7 miles a minute, you could get lost very quickly.
But I mean, even your ground stuff, in the case of being shot down or...
Oh, the survival, absolutely,
Your survival techniques.
They joke about the winter survival one. The one thing that I took from that course was, if you ended up in snow, deep snow, and you could see a house or something where you might think you could find safety, you made sure that you were going to get there.
Yeah.
Because you just might only get halfway and then die with cold or whatever. You know, you had to be certain before you left where you were, because all your kit was with you. Interesting. Good fun. And then the next one was down at Bad Kohlbrook in Germany, which is another minus 18 with your feet sticking out of a parachute tent. That was cold. And when the morning came, you thought, oh, bloody hell. I know not to end up in the snow. No, you know, if it happens, you had an idea what to do then.
Yeah.
What was the kit that you were given? Like, was it good enough for those sort of conditions?
Oh, yeah, survival kit, yeah.
Oh, that's really
good. Part of the ejection seat had a whole box full of stuff. Dare I say, I've still got the machete. But good fun. Good. Yeah. I mean, it's good fun. Good fun. Yeah, do it all again.
I have to try and find a way of finding that crash site.
They are onto it, and I'm told that they're going to find it.
Well, Coombe Ristwyth was the village that I was told.
Yes.
But that's in a... you know, recently I've been there, Coombe Ristwyth.
Okay.
I couldn't believe it. You know, I've been here before. But that was when the four of us came up to try and find the crash site.
And how many years ago? Was it 20 years ago you said that you went to find that?
Oh, no, that was more recent, maybe 10 years ago.
10 years ago.
1982, just before the Falklands War, was the crash. Coombe Ristwyth on the hill, the southern hill, and there was a valley. I mean, I can still remember the valley. And there was nothing else there except the old sheep.
Didn't they? The crash collision went there, didn't they? And they would have recovered everything.
Absolutely. But, you know, just a wonderful experience because I've kept in touch with these guys that came up with me, which was nice. Ex-Navy, Air Force, and Marines. And we got on well, surprisingly.